I want you to take a second and imagine the sheer physical pressure placed on massive steel structures every single day.
Oh, yeah. It's almost unimaginable.
Right. I mean, I'm talking about towering skyscrapers swaying in high winds, or suspension bridges supporting thousands of heavy vehicles during a freezing rush hour.
Or colossal cargo ships crashing through violent ocean waves.
Exactly. How do we keep the thousands of critical welded joints holding these absolute behemoths together from just snapping under all that relentless force?
It's a phenomenal question, and the answer is completely invisible to the naked eye.
Because we usually think of steel as this, uniform, solid block of permanent strength.
Right. But if you zoom in way down to the microscopic level, steel is this highly dynamic, really reactive environment. Its ultimate structural integrity is constantly being decided by the precise ways it is heated and cooled.
And uncovering that invisible process is our mission for today's deep dive. We're jumping into a highly specific, totally fascinating 1991 metallurgical paper.
Titled Mechanism of the Transition from Bainite to Acicular Ferrite.
Yes, authored by S.S. Babu and H.K.D.H. Padicia. And look, while that title might sound like a dense academic lecture, we're going to look at this as an intense microscopic turf war happening right inside the steel.
A turf war that determines if a building stands or falls, basically.
Exactly. We're going to explore the brilliant, honestly almost sneaky way that metallurgists manipulate steel at the atomic level to make it incredibly tough.
The stakes here are as high as they get in commercial engineering. The modern built environment relies entirely on our ability to control these microscopic phase changes.
So let's establish the starting conditions of this turf war. If you're familiar with how steel behaves at extreme temperatures, you know it enters a starting state called austenite.
Think of austenite as the blank canvas.
Right. As the steel is heated, it forms into these distinct microscopic regions or grains, and each one is separated by clear grain boundaries.
And those boundaries are the critical battlegrounds. As the steel begins to cool down from that extreme heat, the austenite becomes unstable. The atomic structure desperately wants to transform into a cooler phase.
Which is where our two competitors enter the arena. They're basically fighting to take over that austenite grain.
Exactly.
Our first competitor is bainite. When the steel cools, bainite naturally prefers to start growing or nucleating right at the boundaries of those austenite grains.
It's the edge hugger.
Yeah, the edge hugger. And as it grows inward toward the center, it forms these long parallel bundles of plates called sheaves. It's highly orderly.
Which, counterintuitively, is the worst-case scenario for structural engineering.
Why is orderly bad?
Because when microscopic plates of metal line up perfectly parallel to one another, it creates a very low resistance path for a crack to travel through.
Ah, so a microfracture just zips right along those lines.
With minimal energy required, that orderly structure makes the steel inherently brittle.
Which brings us to the alternative outcome, the good guy of the story, acicular ferrite.
The highly desired microstructure.
Right. If you want a tough, strong weld that survives a harsh environment, you want acicular ferrite. Because it doesn't grow inward from the edges.
It nucleates intragranularly.
Meaning it starts growing directly from the inside of the grain itself. It seeks out little non-metallic inclusions.
Basically, tiny microscopic impurities or oxide particles floating inside the grain.
And it attaches to those seeds, growing outward in multiple directions.
Now, here is the massive revelation that Babu and Vedatia emphasize early in this paper. It completely shifts how we view these two structures.
Because they look so different under a microscope, right? You'd assume they are fundamentally different materials.
You would. But the core insight here is that acicular ferrite and bainite are chemically and thermodynamically identical.
Wait, they share the exact same chemical composition?
Precisely the same. Acicular ferrite is literally just bainite that managed to nucleate from the inside of the grain instead of from the outside boundaries.
That is wild. Just a simple shift in starting location changes the physical properties.
It changes everything. Because it starts from the inside, growing outward from various random seeds scattered throughout the interior, the growing plates of metal inevitably crash into each other.
And the metallurgical term for this is hard impingement.
Hard impingement, exactly.
And that concept is where the magic happens. Instead of neat parallel bundles that a crack can slice right through, hard impingement creates a chaotic, interlocking structure.
It looks like a complex three-dimensional puzzle of microscopic plates jammed together at all sorts of random angles.
And that chaotic geometry is the entire key to weld toughness.
Because for a crack to to propagate through that interlocking structure, it's forced to constantly change direction at every single plate boundary.
And changing direction requires a massive injection of kinetic energy.
Right. The acicular ferrite structure effectively absorbs the stress, exhausting the energy of the crack and stopping it in its tracks.
So the ultimate goal in modern welding isn't to invent a brand new supermaterial.
No, it's to manipulate the cooling environment so that this specific phase transformation is forced to happen from the inside out.
Okay, so the obvious question is, how do we rig the game? If they're the exact same thing, how do we force the steel to prioritize the internal acicular ferrite over the brittle bainite?
The researchers break this down beautifully in Figure 1 of their paper. They outline three primary physical dials, essentially, that we can turn to favor the intragranular growth.
Let's walk through those. The first dial is inclusion density.
Right, going back to those tiny non-metallic impurities that act as internal seeds. If you deliberately increase the number of those oxide particles inside the grain, you are providing more internal starting points.
More seeds simply means more acicular ferrite is likely to form.
And it impinges upon itself before the bainite can grow inward from the edges and take over. It's a numbers game.
Makes sense. So if inclusion density gives the ferrite more seeds, what about the room it grows in?
That leads directly to the second dial austenite grain size.
Making the grains larger.
Exactly. If you alter your thermal cycles to make the austenite grains physically larger, you dramatically increase the internal volume of the grain while relatively decreasing the surface area of the surrounding boundaries.
Less boundary surface compared to massive interior space. So the internal acicular ferrite gets a geometric advantage.
Precisely.
But both of those methods have practical limits in industrial applications, right?
Right.
Which brings us to the third method discussed in Figure 1.
The most crucial and fascinating mechanism explored in the paper.
It involves introducing a barrier layer, something we might call a microscopic bouncer.
Scientifically, this barrier is a specific microstructure called allotriomorphic ferrite.
Say that one more time.
Allotriomorphic ferrite. Metallurgists discovered that by utilizing very specific cooling rates, you can artificially grow a thin layer of this stuff directly along the austenite grain boundaries.
Before the main transformation even begins, you are intentionally coating the walls of the austenite grain,
laying down a completely new border. And if this thin layer is what the researchers classify as inert, it acts as a physical shield.
It acts as the bouncer.
Right. It stands at the boundary and blocks the bainite from nucleating at the edges. By shutting down the boundary option, the entire transformation is forced to happen internally.
Guaranteeing tough acicular ferrite.
Yes.
So the central mystery of this paper is figuring out exactly how to build that perfect boundary shield. What specific mechanism makes that layer inert, blocking the bainite versus active, where the shield just fails and turns into bainite itself?
The extreme precision these researchers use to isolate this variable is genuinely astounding. It's a masterclass in material science.
They didn't just use a random scrap of steel.
No, they utilized a very specific manual metal arc weld, meticulously packed with precise alloying elements. We are talking about exactly 0.10% carbon,
1.24% manganese,
and 1.87% chromium, alongside other trace elements.
And those specific levels aren't accidental. In high-strength commercial welds, manganese and chromium strongly influence the phase transformation temperatures. By defining these parameters so rigidly, they ensure no stray variables ruin the data.
Exactly. And then they machine the specific weld down into tiny, delicate 3-millimeter diameter rods.
3 millimeters.
Barely anything. Then they baked these rods at 1200 degrees Celsius for 3 full days.
3 days.
That extended high temperature bake is a homogenization process. They are systematically erasing any previous microscopic structures, thermal history, or chemical inconsistencies.
To get an absolutely pure, blank slate of austenite, they even plated the samples in a thin layer of nickel afterward to prevent any external surface oxidation during the heat treatments.
Pristine, highly controlled samples.
Now comes the main event, the heat treatment showdown to build the perfect inert boundary layer. Let's look at the methodology and results of Experiment H1 versus Experiment H2.
Experiment H1 was the successful trial.
Right. They held the steel at 660 degrees Celsius for just 1 minute. This whole time was designed to form that allotriomorphic ferrite layer on the boundaries. Then, they rapidly cooled it, quenching it down to 501 degrees Celsius and letting it hold there.
And the final result was a beautiful, tough structure of pure acicular ferrite everywhere inside the grains.
The boundary layer acted as a perfect inert shield.
But compare that to experiment H2, the failure state. They held the steel at a higher initial temperature to form the boundary layer.
740 degrees Celsius instead of 660.
And held it there for 4 minutes, then quenched it down to 500 degrees Celsius. The result this time was a complete structural failure.
Ainite everywhere.
Growing rapidly inward from the edges. The boundary shield completely failed.
So the only functional difference between success and failure was the temperature at which that initial boundary layer was formed. How does a shift in temperature change the shield into an active pathway for bainite?
The answer lies in the movement of carbon atoms during that initial hold phase. This is the brilliant reveal of the paper.
I love this part.
As the allotriomorphic ferrite layer grows along the boundary edge, its crystal lattice physically cannot hold as much carbon as the austenite it is actively replacing.
So what does it do with the extra carbon?
It partitions it. It effectively sweeps the carbon out, pushing a microscopic, highly localized wave of carbon atoms directly ahead of the advancing boundary layer.
Like a snowplow pushing snow. A localized bottleneck of carbon right at the edge.
Exactly like a snowplow. In experiment H1, at 660 degrees, the thermodynamic conditions were perfect for this carbon wave to bunch up tightly right at the boundary edge.
And this localized spike in carbon concentration acts as an invisible chemical force field.
High carbon levels mathematically depress the temperature at which bainite can physically nucleate. Because that incredibly narrow zone right next to the boundary was now supersaturated with carbon, the bainite physically could not start growing there at 501 degrees.
So the boundary was rendered inert not by a solid wall, but by an invisible wave of trapped carbon.
Yes. But in experiment H2, at the higher 740-degree mark, the thermal dynamics changed. The higher temperature allowed the carbon to diffuse away into the broader grain too quickly.
The snowplow moved too fast, or the snow melted away, basically.
Without that localized carbon spike, there was no invisible force field. The bainite could just freely nucleate the boundaries and ruin the structural integrity of the weld.
It is a phenomenal demonstration of how manipulating localized chemistry, just a microscopic buildup of atoms, completely dictates the macroscopic toughness of the material.
But in the realm of rigorous science, formulating a brilliant theory about a carbon wave isn't enough. They had to prove it definitively.
Which brings us to the sabotage experiments.
My favorite part.
Experiments H3 and H4 are where the scientific elegance of this paper really shines. They theorize that if this invisible carbon force field is truly the single mechanism stopping the bainite, they should be able to build a perfect shield and then deliberately destroy it.
They set up the exact same initial conditions as the successful H1 experiment. Held the steel at 660 degrees for 1 minute to form that perfect layer with the tightly tacked wave of carbon.
But then, instead of quenching it down to let the acicular ferrite form, they deliberately sabotaged the thermal environment.
They spiked the heat. They raised the temperature of the samples back up to 760 degrees in H3 and 750 degrees in H4.
And held them there for a short time.
This process is known as annealing. By spiking the temperature, they injected kinetic energy back into the system, giving those tightly packed carbon atoms the thermal energy they needed to naturally diffuse.
That concentrated wave of carbon acting as the force field was forced to spread out evenly.
Yeah.
They deliberately dissolved their own invisible barrier.
And the result matched their hypothesis perfectly. When they finally quenched the samples back down to 500 degrees, bainite formed everywhere.
Because the edge boundary was entirely unprotected.
This definitively proved that the invisible localized carbon buildup was the exact singular mechanism controlling the transition. The presence of the carbon wave guarantees acicular ferrite.
The absence of it guarantees bainite.
They also ran one final check, experiment H5, which provided a different kind of foundational proof. They took the sample and kept the temperatures entirely above the established bainite start threshold.
Meaning the environment was just too hot for bainite to naturally form under any circumstances.
Right. And the result was that absolutely nothing formed. No bainite, and crucially, no acicular ferrite either.
Proving conclusively that they share the exact same thermodynamic starting line. If the environment is too hot for bainite to begin nucleating, it is inherently too hot for acicular ferrite to begin nucleating.
Reinforcing the earlier revelation that they are thermodynamically the exact same structure, just growing from different points.
While the heat treatment experiments definitively prove the mechanism, it raises a massive logistical question for me. How do you actually measure these microscopic phase changes happening inside solid, glowing hot steel in real time?
You certainly can't just put a piece of 500-degree steel under a standard optical microscope.
Right. This brings us to a highly sensitive piece of laboratory equipment used in the study of the Theta Industries high-speed dilatometer. I want you to consider the staggering precision required here. A dilatometer doesn't visually look at the steel.
It continuously measures microscopic dimensional changes in the actual length of the metal sample as it undergoes thermal transformation.
It is directly measuring the physical expansion of the crystal lattice itself.
Yes. As the face-centered cubic structure of the austenite transforms into the body-centered cubic structure of the ferrite or bainite, the atomic arrangement literally changes shape, taking up a slightly different volume of physical space.
The high-speed dilatometer tracks this microscopic dimensional expansion with incredible precision, allowing the researchers to graph exactly when a phase transformation starts, the velocity at which it moves, and exactly when it ceases.
It is the equivalent of watching the solid steel physically breathe and expand as it changes its internal form.
And the raw data they extracted from this dilatometer, specifically looking at the charts in figures 11 and 12, led to one final, deeply important metallurgical insight. The incomplete reaction phenomenon.
Synthesizing the dilatometer data from figures 11 and 12 reveals something that feels deeply counterintuitive if you are used to standard chemical reactions. Normally, you'd expect a phase transformation to continue progressing until all the chemical elements reach a perfectly balanced, stable chemical equilibrium.
But the dilatometer charts clearly show that the physical expansion of the steel mysteriously halts well before it ever reaches that state of chemical equilibrium.
The physical transformation just stops early.
What does that imply about how these plates are actually forming?
It proves that the physical growth of these bainite and acicular ferrite plates happens at a blindingly fast velocity. The growth is so rapid that there is absolutely no time for the carbon atoms to naturally diffuse or move out of the way during the actual growth event.
So it's only after the microscopic plates have already fully formed and physically locked into their new crystal lattice that the trapped carbon slowly gets partitioned out into the surrounding remaining austenite.
Exactly. That completely upends how you might normally visualize a phase change. It is a massive physical shapeshift first, and a slow chemical rebalancing second.
The lattice snaps into its new formation, tracks the excess carbon inside momentarily, and then the carbon has to bleed out afterward.
It confirms that the transformation is fundamentally displacive. The iron atoms are physically shifting into a new crystal lattice in a cooperative military-style movement, rather than slowly diffusing one by one.
And understanding this exact sequence of events, the displacive physical shift followed by the chemical partitioning of carbon, gives modern engineers the predictive mathematical models they need to design safer welding procedures.
Exactly.
Let's bring all of this sophisticated metallurgy back to where we started. If you have ever driven your car over a massive steel suspension bridge in the dead of winter, the exact mechanisms detailed in Experiment H1 are the reason you make it to the other side safely.
Metallurgists have learned how to play an invisible, microscopic game of atomic control.
By meticulously managing the exact temperatures and cooling rates of the steel, they actively manipulate invisible waves of carbon. They use these trapped carbon waves to act as microscopic bouncers,
completely blocking the weak, brittle, parallel structures from forming at the edges of the grains.
By artificially shutting down those boundaries, they leave the steel no choice but to crystallize from the inside out.
They force it to grow from tiny internal impurities, creating a randomized, chaotic, interlocking puzzle of microscopic plates.
And that highly engineered chaos, the hard impingement of acicular ferrite, is what absorbs the kinetic energy of a fracture, stops catastrophic cracks in their tracks, and keeps the world's most critical infrastructure standing strong against the elements.
It beautifully demonstrates how deeply the macroscale world we live in relies on mastering the microscopic scale, a tiny, highly localized traffic jam of carbon atoms, completely invisible even to a highly advanced optical microscope, literally dictates the physical reality of our most massive engineering feats.
It highlights a profound truth about material science. The strength of a structure isn't just about the bulk material you use.
It's about deeply understanding and manipulating the hidden transitional states that material goes through.
It makes you look at every steel bridge, skyscraper, or cargo ship completely differently. And I want to leave you with a final lingering thought to mull over as you go about your day. If the immense physical strength of a 100-story steel skyscraper relies entirely on manipulating an invisible microscopic wave of carbon pushing against a grain boundary, what other invisible barriers in the material surrounding you right now are secretly holding your world together, just waiting for us to understand how to hack them?